This is John Smith and John Thorne, recorded at the Bass Club Reunion, Cardiff, by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of June 2010. John Smith and John Thorne.
John Smith of 03 of March 1934.
And you were born in
Blackheath.
And we're here today primarily to talk about your time at Detail, which is just the winter of 57 to 58, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Can you give me a little thumbnail sketch of the base you arrived at? What was it like?
It was so different. I had been at Deception Island for the year before that, and when I first came down, we came down via the Falklands, then out to South Georgia, seeing the wondrous sort of landscape there. And then going down to Sydney and, of course, seeing Coronation Island, and that's what it was all about, and seeing the, as I say, incredible view of Coronation. Then we went over to Hope Bay, and I thought, this is marvellous. And then, of course, I knew I was going to Deception, but I didn't really know much about Deception. And when we went in on a very grey day into Deception, seeing the volcanic ash, it was a sad sight, but of course it wore the magic of the place became very evident in our year there.
John Thorne, born 12th November 1928. I was born in Thornton Heath in Surrey. From there, moved up via Streatham, Brixton, Stockwell, through the war, sitting in the Blitz and things before being evacuated up to Lancashire. Came back down from there. Doodlebugs were still flying into London at that time, and I joined the army about a fortnight after VE Day. I joined the Indian Army. I spent just over 12 months at Caterham Barracks on all the basic training, then went to Octo down at Maresfield. And 3 days before I was commissioned, the Indian Army ceased to exist because Mountbatten divided India and Pakistan. So from there, I was transferred to the Queen's Royal Regiment, from then moved out to Egypt. They were not in Egypt, so they offered me the choice of staying in the Canal Zone with the Royal Fusiliers, going to Palestine with the Palestine Police, or going to East Africa. I said East Africa instantly, I think. And they said, right, that's the Somalia Gendarmerie. And I went to the Somalia Gendarmerie as a second lieutenant with a native infantry company up on the Ethiopian border, doing long distance foot patrols, protecting the border, dealing with shifter who were coming in raiding cattle and stuff. And the final thing we did there was to war reparations, and we rounded up 750 camels and a vast amount of money. I'd never seen so much money, which was then divided up among the helpful tribes people, people who had helped us during the campaign there. Came back down from there and back to the UK and was demobbed.
How did you end up in FITS then?
How did I end up? Well, coming back, my big thing then was to go into road haulage on what was to be the Cape Town to Cairo Road, which again was one of these things, just as they got it started and the groundnut scheme was going underway. They decided aircraft would fly up and down to Cape Town far quicker than a lorry going up and down a road. So the road never started. And I was going through college at that time as a mechanical engineer, working in a garage part-time and weekends and holidays. And started rowing in Thames skiffs, doing all sorts of things, going off, walking in the lakes, climbing, doing some climbing courses, and then got a job with Sir George Godfrey, who made the turbo compressors. They are turbine and compressor people for many years, but my job was the test engineer on the air conditioning units for the big aircraft, the passenger aircraft and the V-bomber fleet. So I was reading Met instruments all day long. My brother-in-law went to Norway with British Schools Exploring Society as the first non-service leader. He was a teacher. And the following year, he led a Millfield School expedition to Norway, and I went with him as an assistant. And about a year after that, I was at work. My rigger came in and said, "There's a job for you in the paper today." And it was the Old News Chronicle. And we found a copy in somewhere, I think in one of the powerhouses in the factory, because we had three power stations. And got the paper, went up to the office, told the girl, "Stop doing any of this other work here, I'll write a letter." And I applied for the job as a general assistant mountaineer, general assistant handyman, and an ionospheric assistant, but I'm sorry, I don't know what it is.
So you applied for three jobs, in fact?
So I applied for three jobs.
Which one did you get?
I didn't get any of them. I was interviewed by Frank Elliott, and I must admit, I don't think there was anyone else there. I can't remember anyone else being there other than Frank. And as we talked, he said, "Well, the work you're doing is all the instruments associated with Met." And it is. I was reading all the instruments every few minutes. So he said, "Answer is, go to Stanmore, do a short course, become a meteorologist for Met assistant." Nothing happened. Didn't hear anything then, and that was about June or July. I didn't hear anything till about October, and I phoned up, and they said, "There's a signal on the way to you, a telegram on the way to you." And that night I got it. A three-page telegram, which was a contract to go as a Met observer with FIDS, sailing on the 12th of November, my birthday. Very, very distinctive day for Antarctic stuff it is, by the way. And as to go as a locally trained Met observer. Another page to answer the contract on and sign the details, which I did, and bingo, got on board the Andes on the 12th of November. Anniversary of the day they found Scott, Wilson and Bowers. And the anniversary of the day Ross sailed from Tasmania, seen off by Fitzroy.
We're here today to talk about your time in detail, yeah. the two of you, John Thorne and John Smith. But you arrived first, you arrived there, you're part of the...
I'm on the original setup.
Yeah. So when you sailed in for the very first time, describe the scene you saw.
Well, we'd had about 3 days going up and down, and we'd obviously been out in Martha Strait because we crossed the circle twice, and that we could only have done by going out that far North Adelaide way. We looked at all sorts of things, but everywhere was restricted. They could not spot a landing at any point. And we came in onto detail. Series of snowy covered humps, fairly low down in the water, Andresen quite a bit higher one side, Leard out the other side, much higher. But it looked as though you could get a landing. And a party went ashore, and it was, I know it included Tom Murphy, who was our base leader, surveyor, but I'm not sure who the others were. There were ship's officers and people to look at the landing site. And came back and said, "Yes, it goes, it's all right, there's room to put a building, there is room to land, there is etc. etc." But we then had usual base W weather, 36 hours waiting for the wind to stop. And then we started unloading 23rd of Feb, yeah. In 56.
There was some debate as to where to put the hat, wasn't there?
There was a certain amount of debate about it, but I really think when you look at that place, that island, if you were going to use that island, that was really the one site. Because it was the site that at that point was fairly clear of snow, so you could see the rock base where you would put your piers and things of that type.
What sort of hut did you erect?
Bolton and Paul prefab. So there were concrete piers went in, then you put down your floor bearers, into the floor bearers, you put your hardboard and then your insulation layer, and then two layers of tongue and groove boarding. And on that, you erected the framework and worked up boarding it and going.
So John Smith, when you arrived a year later, what was before your eyes when you sailed into the bay?
A very attractive proposition. It was a hut completed and a very comfortable base indeed. And so all the work had been done. I can't really remember having to do anything really as far as the hut was concerned. It was very shortly getting out in the field. So basically all that work had been done. And of course they'd done already a lot of sledging. So that year was an incredibly effective year, although you had problems. But it was a welcoming sight, particularly after, in some ways, Deception. But Deception was very good in the end. But it was good to go down the whole of the peninsula and then arrive at W, yes.
How sophisticated was the Met equipment?
Sorry?
How sophisticated was the Met equipment by then?
It was all in place. I can't remember if I went straight on Met when I got there, because I don't think I was there very long before we went over to the mainland. But everything was there. The Met tower was there with the anemometer and the screen, of course, Stevenson screen, all set up. And the Met room inside with the barograph and the... everything was there, all in place.
We had actually started doing Met Obs in the last day of June, ready for the International Geophysical Year.
So was detail established because of the IGY?
I think if you look at the history, it really was. It was one of the many infill places to build up this network of stations. But it was put in for Met surveying and geology of that area, because the surveying of that area was very vague.
And you did some surveying the first year?
We did some. They went up as far as Cape Ray on the sea ice, the surveyors, having a look to see if there was any way they could get up onto the plateau from there. They came back and Tom stayed, I think, Mike Orford and Hedley Wright, I think, were the three who went over and found a way up from what is now was the Orford Cliff Rescue Hut, Refuge Hut, over the top and down onto the glacier, and you could see it looked as though you found a glacier. They came back from that, changed party, so it was Mike Orford, Tom Murphy, the two surveyors, Ron Miller as the mountaineer, who then went back and pushed their way right up onto the plateau on what is now the Murphy Glacier.
So part of your brief was to do the surveying?
That was to get the surveying in and find geographical. And the geologist, Hedley Wright, interesting character, he did a certain amount on that sort of mainland cliff. He then went round a part of the bottom south end of the field and had a fairly rough time, and then I went out with him to Anusi Bay, and the history then comes that I never got back from that one until HMS Protector arrived with its helicopters.
Well, let's talk about that now. We'll come back to John Smith in a moment to his time. Tell me about this story about Anusi Bay and what happened.
We went out to Anusi Bay, Hedley Wright and myself, end of September, I think that's right. Just a quick check. They got back on the 22nd of September from it. No. Yeah, we went out on the 25th of September, and we went to Rue Island, cross into Anusi Bay, to the Bennett Islands. Didn't get much further. Conditions were absolutely atrocious. Deep, wet snow, layup after layup after layup, lots of wind. But we then plodded across not as far as the most westerly of the Bennetts, and then went south down, and I got the channel names wrong because we didn't have them on. There were no names on the original map. of Tickle Channel and Gunnell Channel, but we went down Tickle Channel as far as the what is now the gullet, known as the gullet, and where we ran into broken ice and seawater. And we came up back up from there following the coastline up, had a long layup, a three-day layup, but luckily got a big seal, so we fed all the dogs, because poor old Yap, who was the great lead dog, had cracked up completely. He only had these little short legs and real deep wet snow, he couldn't cope. And 3 days of that, and then we moved on, and old Yap went back into the lead. He said, I'm the lead dog, I'm going back. And we romped along with the dogs, absolutely marvellous, after this big blow. Worked our way back, decided that instead of going north round Roo Island, we would go through the channel between Roo and the Arrowsmith Peninsula. So we went past the points there and the point which now bears my name. Got a geological sample from there. As we went through the channel, at the far end, we were being iced up. We were on a compass course, just pushing round. As we got through, we started crossing cracks in the ice. And then it was absolutely black. I can still see this black wall in front of us. And as we got closer to it, we realised it was just a big, big sea running out in front of us. Very rough, very choppy. And we followed tight round the coast of Roo Island and ran up an ice ramp to where we had got a food depot. That night it blew up 80 odd knots and the ice ramp disappeared. 3 days later, the dinghy came over with Ron Miller and Dave Moore, the radio operator. They took two of the dogs, started off back. They'd come over in absolute flat calm. Within, they only stayed with us 20 minutes, 30 minutes at the most. Set off back. As they poked their nose out and got out into the wind, there it was. The wind was back blowing hard. They got swamped. Both of them, well, Ron Miller quotes it as the worst half hour of his life. Dave Moore said, I owe my life to Ron on that day. And I've got that in their letters to me. But they came back and got back to us in a pretty shaken state. Luckily, Tom Murphy had insisted on them taking survival kit. So they had a mounting tent and sleeping bags, and they moved in and camped. The pack started to consolidate at the beginning of November, and on about, I think it was somewhere, there we go, I might have it. Yeah, on the 9th of November, Hedley and Ron actually skied back. Ron used my skis and Hedley had his, and they skied back to base. But they signalled to us not to attempt it because the dogs would have straight lined it as soon as they heard the dogs and would have gone straight through all the broken stuff. So we stayed and they told us that there was a ship coming. In fact, we heard Gene Donnelly, the operator at Y, talking to his party, and he told us more than our base could. Our base couldn't get through to us. But so they used to signal us with an Aldis lamp. And the helicopters came in on the 10th, and that is one of those great classics.
When they got back to base, was there any discussion about what happened, what went wrong, and how it could be avoided again?
I think, without a doubt, we all looked at it very hard, and we came to the conclusion that what we said to do with the dinghy as a backup emergency was a perfectly good plan. But I don't think we had got used to the vagaries of the weather in Lanaman Field.
When you arrived, John, of course, you got yourself into a pickle with Dennis Goldring, didn't you?
That was a pickle a lot later on, because we went over to the mainland, to the refuge, and this was with Dennis Goldring. And basically the four of us there, Jim Medell, Angus Erskine, and of course Dennis and myself, And to begin with, it was a matter of training dogs before. And Angus wanted to take a film of the training of dogs, which he then did. But the idea was to, of course, do the survey and to go up to the plateau and to find any rock exposure for Dennis. And I suppose for how long were we there? For three, 4 months on the mainland. And we established a baseline, or Jim and Angus established a baseline for the triangulation, the map making in that area. And then, of course, going to various peaks and prominent points round about to do the round of angles to create the map as they did in those days. Times have changed somewhat these days. But we had, like you did, a lot of very bad weather, a lot of lying up. And I think at that time people didn't really realise the state of ice. We hadn't enough records of what is likely to happen. And the vicissitudes of course, Marguerite Bay and with us on two occasions, certainly with yours, that was a terrible occasion. We didn't realise, you know, the potential for the breakup that obviously happened. But anyway, we sledged up to the plateau and relayed a lot of stuff. I don't know how many times we sort of had to go backwards and forwards to get up to the top there. But we did eventually get up there and established quite a big depot right up on the top of the Avery Plateau. And then the idea was for Angus and Jim to go south. And Dennis and myself were going to again go to any rock exposures up there, which we had one perfect day. On the route up there, just before we got to the plateau, we had temperatures of minus 29, which was quite cool. But on that day when we split up, after establishing the depot, Dennis and I went a bit to the north and found one or two rock exposures there by Castle Peak, and thought, what a marvellous, marvellous time that was. It was absolutely still air, and you could look right down the Murphy Glacier. You could see Adelaide in the distance. Quite something. But that night, things changed somewhat. It was a howler, and it blew solidly for 7 days. And we were getting a bit worried because although we had depots laid down below us, we were running out of man food and dog food. We hadn't expected quite such a long lie up, and of course we had the depot not too far away up on top, and we had one down below. But during the blizzard, and Angus records that time as being one of the worst experiences of his life as far as polar exploration went, because he was on the British North Greenland expedition. What he hadn't catered for, hadn't experienced, was the incredible snow accumulation that happened. So after 7 days, and that's right, one of the dogs pupped, and of course all were dead. It was a very sad happening. But Dennis and I, during that time, I think we were playing Battleships. Remember that game?
Yes. Yes, I've got note of you playing Battleships.
And reading Dickens. quite incredible. Anyway, fortunately, the wind abated and we saw the moon, and that was the time we knew we could get moving. So we broke camp early and then set down the glacier, but we hadn't catered for the deep snow. And even though we were going down a steep slope, the dogs couldn't. It disappeared under the snow. And so I had to go ahead, breaking at some sort of trail, even with skis, which were up to my knees. It was absolutely incredible accumulation. And we became worried because the days were getting quite short. And we knew it was quite a way to go. We knew where it was, or almost roughly where it was. And it then was getting dark. And it was a situation which you had to do something. We couldn't have gone on with all the sledge load we had. We were going far too slow. We just couldn't get to the point where we knew the depot was. And so we thought, well, the only thing to do in this situation is to quickly put the tent up, and obviously everything upright, and simply go ahead with the dogs, light loaded, to get the stuff in the depot. And we got to down to where the depot should be and saw nothing. And of course it was getting dark. So I said to Dennis, the only thing we can do is to grid, go across the area. And we just couldn't see anything. And then I saw the top of the adrenaline pole sticking out that much.
About an inch.
About an inch of pole. And I can't remember the sequence of events here exactly, but what we did, we managed to get some dog food out, and then we thought we've got to get back to the camp. And we started to go back, and the wind got up. And of course, that soft snow, just couldn't see a thing. And so the only thing to do in that situation, as far as we were concerned, was to basically stay there. At least we had food, and we could dig a snow hole. And we dug a snow hole. It was very comfortable in there, and then we suddenly realised, as because all the drift was happening, we were getting blocked in, and that wouldn't work. So we thought, well, the only thing to do, because it wasn't too low a temperature, we thought, well, we'll just have a hole each alongside each other, and we will simply count right through the night, and if he stopped counting, I then carry on, but if you didn't, you woke the other one up. And so this was the pattern of the night. But we had dog food to eat. There was man food there as well, but we couldn't get to it at that time. The second night we got to it, but we had two nights there. The second night we had a much better system. We put the skis across and I can't remember what we put over, but we were better off, but we couldn't still make the journey up to the campsite. But then it all abated and we got back to the camp and it was all right. But and of course you remember the force of the wind that has done this deed to us.
I was recording here. I'd been on the night met of the first night, which was, according to me, was, I think, the 25th of May. I think that's right, 25th, 26th of May. And I have recorded very high wind speeds coming up. And in the day when Bill McDowell took over as Met that day, we had the fantastic weather, southerly gale, northerly hurricane with gusts to 100 knots, 110 mile an hour, then a southerly gale with gusts up to 60 knots, overcast or cloudy showers, snow showers, drift. But the barometer fell 170 points in 3 hours and then rose 102 in 3 hours. And I got up at 1 o'clock after being woken by Mac telling me the stores outside were all being blown away. And I went out and restacked them after lunch, and my comment was, oh, it's only a gale, fairly typical. But what was interesting was when I look at, and I have got Dennis's notes of what happened to the two of them up on the top, we, I think, were in a genuine cyclone, but ours was funneled because of the shape of the glacier, of the field. Whereas they up on the glacier were really on the outskirts and getting this incredible dump of snow. Mm. They were really getting it. And I know from John Killingbeck working out on Adelaide the opposite way, they often got an accumulation of similar depths over that site. So it looks as though this was the dump on the edge of the cyclone's rotation.
So whilst John Smith and Dennis were in their snow holes, was there anything new, John Thorne, and the base could do?
We had no idea where they were.
No radio communication?
No radio communication.
No radios?
We had 68 sets, these ex-army man packs, which did not really work very well the first year. But I cannot understand, by the end of the second year, they were working so marvellously. I don't know how we managed to have them working so well at the end. And we did get strange things with them later on. But I think on this sort of thing, we knew that they were having a rough time, but there was absolutely nothing we could do.
But going back to that experience, there was just no way you could get any further. Now, when you've got a good snow surface, the wind has blown and you've got it crusted up, and you can travel far and fast. And we could have got down that particular glacier in a day.
Yeah.
But when you've got that condition, and we had days when we had soft snow and you could make maybe a quarter of a mile, half a mile. And then other days, you could do 30. And that was the huge difference that it, you know, happened with that sort of weather.
This was really very similar to what we had had over in Hennussy Bay the year before. Incredible snow dumps, and we made several days where we made a quarter of a mile and half a mile for a whole day's hard, really hard slog sledging. So this was one of the sort of problems. But one thing we, if we go back just a little bit, because this relates to what happened to detail, on the 1st of Jan, 56, we were the first base that Prince Philip visited. And he came in with the governor and the American inquiry and things. And you can have this bit. And there, we had the first game of tennis played in the Antarctic between Raymond Priestley and the American Observer.
Were they still well after the meal I prepared for them?
Well, no, they had the meal after us. They went up to you afterwards.
I thought
we were first to Jan.
Oh, I see.
The Britannia went just to deception after details.
Yes, that's right.
And that's why you prepare this rather strange meal, John, which you might want to elaborate on briefly.
Well, I thought it was only a natural thing to do to sort of feed the people sort of with the local fodder. And so I thought when I was on, it was my turn on Cook that particular week.
Deception,
yes. And so I thought, oh dear, what do I do? So I thought, well, we've got to get, I went out and got a seal and penguin eggs, and I thought that's what I'm going to do for the main meal. And that I did. And when asked whether they would like steak and kidney pie, or whether you would like seal steak and seal liver and penguin omelette, they all except one, I think, chose the local. And that was an entertaining time.
So penguin omelette, not penguins themselves?
And not the penguin. No, we tried penguin on occasion, but really you needed a lot of curry and a lot of this and that to really somehow take away from a certain flavour of penguin, which I didn't appreciate. I don't know about you, John.
I was quite a penguin fan. I roast penguin on many occasions. or fried it, yes.
But after the meal, I don't know if it was a consequence of that, that we had a marvellous time on board Britannia, because they then invited us on board, the Duke of Madison on board. We had an incredible evening on there. In the wee small hours, we were taken back ashore, but they put a film on for us. And in the morning, of course, the Duke from his own pantry sent a whole lot of fresh fruit ashore. Now, well, that was a consequence of what he saw we had to have. I don't know.
But that the detail?
At detail, no. Yeah. I was dressed in sledging gear with tent up and things to display our equipment. Prince Philip went up, had a good look at the puppies that we had at that time, and he then went up to the penguin rookery up at the beacon and then came back in the hut for just a cup of tea and the biscuits or cakes or something of that type.
He was incredibly interested in everything.
Oh, absolutely. It was a fascinating one. And to have someone like Sir Raymond Priestley there as well, wonderful, with all his experience, right back to days of Scott, linking it all together. Absolutely. It was a superb day.
And at deception, he went over to Fidassi, the aero survey, and of course was very interested in what they had achieved with the flying at that time, with the aero photography. He showed a very keen interest in what was happening.